Hi, everybody. I'm Tom Hall. This is Midday. In this unusual political cycle, much has been made of the unpopularity of both Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton. But being popular is one of those encomiums that's also used to describe a powerful political movement. Father Charles Coughlin, George Wallace, Ross Perot, Jack Kemp, Jesse Jackson, Ralph Nader, Bernie Sanders, and yes, Donald Trump, all established a particular connection with disaffected people concerned about a range of issues from the economy to immigration. My guest today traces the history of populism on both sides of the Atlantic and the reasons for the recent surge in its appeal. John Judas is here to talk about his new book, The Populist Explosion: How the Great Recession Transformed American and European Politics. First, the news.
When Mexico sends its people, they're not sending their best. They're not sending you. They're not sending you. They're sending people that have lots of problems, and they're bringing those problems with us. They're bringing drugs, they're bringing crime, they're rapists, and some, I assume, are good people. But I speak to border guards, and they tell us what we're getting.
And welcome to Midday, everybody. On 88.1, I'm Tom Hall, and for the last year and a half, political pundits have been scratching their heads trying to figure out the ascendance of Donald Trump. 17 months ago, he began his most recent presidential campaign with a rambling 45-minute peroration at Trump Tower, and at the time, it appeared that the greatest consequence he'd face after the scores of bigoted diatribes that would follow was the disillusionment of his relationship with NBC and Univision. But the reality TV star quickly proved that there was no such thing as a gaffe in the land of the Donald. From war heroes to women, he demeaned just about everyone at one time or another, denied doing or saying many of the things that he has clearly done or said, and fabricated a good bit of stuff that he has never, in fact, done or said. His supporters applaud this kind of incendiary rhetoric and habitual mendacity, delighted that Mr. Trump tells it like it is. And when the dust settled after the primaries, of course, he was the last person standing. He won big. Republican primary voters, who many thought to be simply a weird fringe element of an otherwise sane, predictable, and proud party, turned out to be much more mainstream than many ever imagined. Recent polling shows that 87% of Republicans now support Mr. Trump. That's a few points higher than the number of Democrats who support Secretary Hillary Clinton. Is Donald Trump an aberration, a flash in the pan whose political moment will fade as soon as the more mature and seasoned candidate wins on November 8th? Well, that outcome is far from certain. Many people cling to the hope that America will, of course, come to its senses and reject the notion that our country is in need of being made great and that immigrants and Muslims and the stupid people who are doing our deals need not be replaced by a man with absolutely no experience in the arena of national or global politics, nor the temperament to handle the pressures and unpredictability of the world's most consequential office. So in this theory, the newspaper editorial boards are right, the Republican primary voters are wrong. Well, it turns out that those Republican primary voters have many antecedents in American and European politics. My guest today has written a book that traces the history of populism as a political movement, from Huey Long in Louisiana in the 1930s through George Wallace's run for president in 1968, through Donald Trump's persistent candidacy that appears to have a base of support that is larger than almost anyone imagined it could be in the summer of 2015. John Judas suggests that the ground Trump is tilling became fertile during the financial crisis of 2008 and 2009, and that the populism of the left, with figures like Bernie Sanders, grew out of this same soil. The book is called The Populist Explosion: How the Great Recession Transformed American and European Politics. John Judas lives in Silver Spring, and he joins me this afternoon in Studio A. It's great to meet you. Thanks for coming in.
Yeah, my pleasure.
So let's get right to the heart of your thesis here. In what ways did the Great Recession of 2008 and 2009 lead to this rise of what you call in the title of your book, the populist explosion?
Well, I think it did because it created disillusionment with a economic political worldview that had been prevailed in the country since the 1970s, early 1980s. And really, it's not the first time. The first kind of explosion of this kind that predates Trump and Sanders was Ross Perot in 1992. And he was talking about many of the same things, although in a much more sanitized, left-leaning way than Trump. He was talking about NAFTA, the trade deal, sucking jobs out of America, which he proved to be correct about. And he was talking about corporations that were irresponsible, that weren't, that didn't act in the national interest, that were eager to get out of the country and go to Mexico or overseas, banks. So a lot of the same issues were present with Perot. They went underground during the late 90s because we had a boom then. Then you had a period of where there was the war on terror and people were scared to death of terrorists. And then when the Great Recession happened, they resurfaced again, and they resurfaced with a vengeance in both the left wing of the Democratic Party and in the Republican Party. And the thing about Trump is that he is a maverick. I mean, some Republicans in Washington refer to him as a liberal, not a conservative. You have to step away for a moment from his most incendiary statements about Mexican rapists, his statements about women, his incitement to violence at the rallies, and look at the kind of issues that he's raising and how those have a relationship to this worldview that has prevailed since the late 70s, early 80s. I'm referring to two things in particular. You can almost derive everything about our current policy from two things. The first is capital mobility. The corporations should be able to move wherever they want, that banks themselves should be able to do their business anywhere in the world without restrictions, that there should be deregulation of banking so our banks can compete better with banks overseas. So that's one part of it. The other part is labor mobility. That to a great extent, if people want to work in a different country than they live in, they should be free to do so. And that was true in the European Union and became true in the United States, where we had this tremendous upsurge in immigration after 1965 and then after 1990, where the limits were raised even more. And so you had both legal immigration then and you had illegal immigration. The effect of all these things was to create a different kind of economy. Capital mobility meant a lot of people got rich at the top, and not just at the 1%, but let's say the top third, the people who work in the information economy, finance, real estate, things like that. Where at the same time, you had a decimation of the old mid-waged manufacturing sector, a lot of which moves out of the country. And you had pressure on the bottom third or half from immigrants coming into this country. And particularly, I'm not talking about computer programmers, but I'm talking about more unskilled, semi-skilled immigrants coming from the South and also from overseas that put pressure on wages, raise social costs in towns like the towns in Iowa that you always find oddly up in arms during the Republican primaries about immigration. So Trump comes on the scene, and I went to his first rally in, it was like in August of 2015 in New Hampshire, and I really didn't know what to expect. There was a line that reached all around this high school. It was like going to a movie premiere of The Godfather in 1970 or something. I mean, it was just amazing, or the Rolling Stones. And what Trump talked about really surprised me. He talked about Ford moving its assembly plant to Mexico. He said, if I'm president, I'm going to prevent those kind of things from happening. I'll slap a 35% tax on their products coming back. And they're free to move, but they're going to have trouble selling. He talked about the Nabisco company in Chicago, my hometown, going to Mexico. And he said, I'm not going to eat Oreos anymore. He talked about corporations moving their headquarters overseas to avoid taxes. So there was this whole dimension of his politics often unreported and often obscured by his more incendiary, racist, bigoted, whatever remarks that got a lot of appeal, too, from the voters there, but that distinguished him from other Republicans.
You write about the commonalities between some of the populists in American politics and European politics, but also the sort of thread, the lineage of people. You started with Father Coughlin in the 30s, right, and Huey Long and Perot, even guys like Jack Kemp, you mentioned, or on the left, Bernie Sanders, Ralph Nader, maybe Jesse Jackson, people like that. They all had this ability to connect with people in a particular way. And you write about how the folks who are in the current instance of Mr. Trump, the folks who are drawn to his candidacy feel squeezed from both the top and the bottom. I mean, it's funny how the middle class seems to be disappearing, but that cohort is feeling pressure and great dissatisfaction with both the establishment politics and the establishment as represented by Washington or big government, as well as the bottom. So has Trump tapped into that, do you think, as well? Because here's a billionaire real estate guy,
right,
being, you know, Joe the plumber.
And you have to remember Ross Perot was a billionaire, too.
Yeah.
And he financed his own campaign. And he said to people, you know, you don't have to worry about special interests because I'm going to pay for the whole thing. Populism in America has most often been a politics of the lower middle class, not of the most poor people. That was true in Louisiana during Huey Long's heyday. The populists in the 1890s were they weren't the most prosperous, but they weren't the farmers who were suffering the most. And today, Trump's constituency is, you would say, middle class. It's not some pollster said after Republican primaries that he got, upper income voters. But that was because he gets older voters, and older voters have, on average, a higher income than younger voters. So it looked like he was tilting upwards. But it's a very much a middle class constituency that feels, you know, the Brits use this word "left behind." That's a very common sentiment, and it is an idea that and this is characteristic of the conservative brands of populism, the idea that there's a elite that's betraying you. You are the people. You're the heart of America. You're the mainstream, the heartland. There's an elite and establishment that is that's scornful of you. But in addition to doing bad things on their own, they're coddling this third group, and it consists maybe of immigrants, African Americans, Muslims, whatever. So that's then the characteristic of the more conservative right-wing brands of populism in the United States. The left wing doesn't have that third dimension. It's just the people against the establishment. Even though, like the right wing, the left, Sanders did not have attract the lowest income voters. He attracted college students who don't have any income, but it was college educated and beyond mm-hmm. voters were the heart of his constituency. So, you know, populism has this odd kind of.
Yeah. You write about this in the book, and you've been covering politics for a long time. You were at Talking Points Memo. Now you're at the New Republic for a long time. Has Trump taken over the Republican Party? I mean, the Republican Party's basic core constituency from the late 1800s was the business class, were the owners, the barons, the people who were running and operating manufacturing and business in the United States. The Tea Party made its self known in the last election cycle, the last couple. They seem to be much more to the fringes this time around. But has Trump disassociated the Republican Party from its deep connection to people in business?
Well, I think that's true for this election. I mean, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, which became a mainstay of the Republican Party in the 1990s, is not endorsing Trump, which is amazing. That's the first presidential candidate in a long time that it hasn't thrown its weight behind. The Business Roundtable, all these major groups. Clinton will probably get a majority or close to that in the managerial section, the highest income people in the land. So that's a novelty, to be sure. I think if Trump loses, and I expect he will, that the business class, they call themselves the traditional conservatives, are going to reassert their control over the party. But it's a volatile mix. They definitely have a problem.
Yeah, indeed, clearly, because this is a close race. I mean, there are a lot of folks who agree with you that Secretary Clinton will prevail, but there's all sorts of evidence to the contrary, and we'll have to see how that plays out over the next 5 weeks. John Judas, his new book, is called The Populist Explosion: How the Recession Transformed American and European Politics. We'll have more with John Judas after a quick break. You can join us. Give us a call, 410-662-8780. Drop us an email, midday@wipr.org, or send me a tweet, @MiddayTomHall. It's Midday. I am Tom Hall. Stick with us.
It's all about popular. It's not about aptitude. It's the way you're viewed. So it's very shrewd to be very, very popular. Like me.
I'm Tom Hall. Welcome back to Midday. My guest today is John Judas. His new book is called The Populist Explosion: How the Recession Transformed American and European Politics. On the subject of immigration, which John writes a lot about in the book, the United States is one of 32 countries that accepts referrals from the UN High Commission for Refugees as part of its international effort to secure resettlement for about 10% of Syrian refugees. And as of this year, the UNHCR has secured commitments from these 32 countries to admit more than 220,000 Syrians for permanent resettlement, humanitarian admission, private sponsorship, or academic scholarship. So since the start of the Syrian civil war, the United States has provided nearly $5.9 billion in humanitarian assistance, with $364 million of that being added just last week. That's more than any other donor. But to date, just 1/5 of 1% of Syrian refugees, 1/5 of 1%, have been resettled in the United States. In November of 2015, Donald Trump said that if he were elected president, he would deport all Syrian refugees who settle in the United States. If you want to join our conversation, you can give us a call, 410-662-8780. You can drop us a tweet, @MiddayTomHall, or send us an email, midday@wipr.org. So, John, Trump's campaign was sort of premised on immigration and fear of immigration. This is also, we're seeing this thing, the same sentiment play out in Europe. Which is the chicken and which is the egg? Did Trump borrow from his European counterparts on the far right populist fringe or populist movement, or did he pick up something that was original and American on this side of the world?
Yeah, it's been going on in America since the late 1980s, and California, 1994, had a big referendum that was very controversial about immigration. Arizona, when Trump thought he might become the Reform Party, Ross Perot's party nominee in 2000, that was one of the issues that he said he agreed with Pat Buchanan about. Now, Pat Buchanan, again, I think he was the first presidential candidate to make a big deal about immigration in 1992 and 1996. So Trump's been on this issue before. I think it's the kind of issue that he found that he was getting a tremendous response from and sort of amped up his appeal.
You do write that it's difficult to define populism in terms of right, left, or center. You talk about the term fascism and how that's used, and, right. And there are people who are applying that term to Donald Trump and to others in Europe in particular. We talk about how you understand those terms and how you think most people do understand and perhaps should understand populism and a populist notion of politics.
Well, I think the main thing about populism is, again, this kind of demarcation, this frontier between the people and the elite. That's the central idea on the left, right, and center of populism. I think the second thing about it is that populists in general make demands of the elites that they will not, that they are not going to agree to. They don't make negotiable demands. Bernie Sanders didn't ask in his campaign that we should have coverage under Medicare for hearing aids. We don't now. What he asked for was Medicare for all. Now, you know, everybody's going to laugh off that in Washington. That's not going to happen. We have a Republican Congress. But that captured, for many young Americans in particular, it seemed, what things should be, how things should be. Trump's wall. Again, he's not going to build this wall. And if you interview some of his supporters, they don't really think that he's going to build this kind of great wall in China that goes from, you know, the Texas border all the way to California. But it symbolized his refute, you know, his utter rejection of the idea that anybody should cross the country, cross the border illegally. So that's another characteristic of populism, which is this kind of non-negotiable demand. So that's what separates the people from the elite. One of the surprising things in Europe is that the populist parties there that are sometimes described as far right or, you know, extremist, have domestic programs that are to the left of the Democratic Party in the United States. The French.
So they're to the right really only on the issue of immigration.
Yes. And even there, I mean, you could imagine a position on immigration that was not, quote, right wing. It was one that would say employers shouldn't have these put people in competition with each other, because a lot in the United States, for instance, it's against the law for employers to hire illegal immigrants, people who are undocumented. But they, for the most part, ignore it, and the federal government does not enforce it. So you could have a policy that wanted more restrictive immigration that wasn't, in that sense, right wing. But what happens is there's scapegoating. It's not the fault of the employers. It's the fault of these Mexican rapists or whatever. All Muslims are terrorists. And that's the edge to it that I would say makes a lot of these parties, like the National Front in France, right wing rather than left wing. But on domestic policy, national health insurance, banks, nationalized banks, they have like a program that Bernie Sanders would be happy to embrace.
John Judas, the new book is called The Populist Explosion, How the Great Recession Transformed American and European Politics. We're going to go to the phones now. LB is on the line from Dundalk with a comment about immigration. LB, welcome to Midday. Glad you called.
Hey, Tom. This is a great show. To be honest, I use this in the sports to get away from all this, but this is great. I grew up in Baltimore, and I remember a time when you could get a job. In fact, they had men's and women's were in the newspaper. It was different sections for jobs. Anyway, I had a good education, but didn't go through college. And back then, again, like I said, you could just get jobs. Maryland Cup over on the southwest side was a big thing. Where I live now is Sparrows Point, all those jobs. Then I got into landscaping. And right around the late 80s, I worked at Gaither College for like 10 years. And in the morning on the bus, I started seeing a lot of Hispanic guys, you know, going to landscaping. And by the 90s, the only, I don't know how else to say it, the only white guy you would see would usually be the foreman on these crews. And so now it's like the working class, which was such an important, and it's not even a term anymore. You know, it's just them and us, and it's just sad. But and I don't know how you're going to figure it out, because I'm 63, so I'm on the way out of it, but it's just sad to see it, that life of a working class and be able to get a decent job and just live a good life. I don't know where it's gone, but I hope it can come back someday.
Well, thanks for your call, LB. So, John Judas, there is this notion, an impression that immigrants are taking away jobs from the working class. What's the actual data about that?
The data is very controversial, and you'll get people on both sides of this. My view is that that's correct, that there have been all kinds of different jobs. He mentioned construction, roofers, for instance. You can also look at the meatpacking industry. The meatpacking industry in the Midwest used to be, unionized, mid-wage. It's now largely immigrant. It's low wage, semi-skilled. Transformed a lot of small towns in the Midwest, and also what happened there accounts for a lot of the anti-immigrant sentiment that you see in places like Iowa. So there are jobs, and you sometimes hear it say, "Well, these are dirty jobs that only immigrants will take." And the counterexample to that, of course, is garbage, sanitation workers, which in many cities is unionized, middle-class wages, and that people are eager to take. So I think that it is true that in this lower third of the working class, the lower half, employers did use immigrants to drive down wages and also to make unionization difficult. And so I think this fellow has a point.
What about Trump's contention that immigrants are also responsible for a good bit of crime? Is there any evidence to support that claim?
Because
it seems to me that there's plenty of evidence to support an exactly opposite claim. Immigrants, of all people, are worried about their status. They're worried about being deported. They're worried about becoming noticed in any way whatsoever. So they are among the least likely people living in the United States to commit crimes.
I'm not going to comment on that because I don't know. I don't know the answer. In Europe, there's been a lot of very high-profile cases, like the rapes and assaults of women on New Year's in Cologne, Germany, that have partly involved asylum seekers, refugees, that have certainly contributed to the anti-immigrant, anti-asylum seeking sentiment there. But in terms of the United States percentages, what it looks like, I don't know.
John Judas is my guest this afternoon. On Midday, I'm Tom Hall. The book is called The Populist Explosion, How the Great Recession Transformed American and European Politics. It's interesting that you notice that populism and populists often believe their demands are worthy, but they don't actually expect to win. They don't actually expect the establishment to grant what they're demanding. Is that true that they are sort of fundamentally idealistic with no real expectation that they're going to be able to make a dent in the body politic?
Well, it's not that they're entirely up in the air, starry-eyed. I think Bernie Sanders would argue that in the end, Medicare for all is the only solution. If you looked at the New York Times today, there's a story on the front page about how Obamacare is basically falling apart and has to be repaired. And the question of how is very much, again, something that has to be resolved. But the reason there is this distinction in populism between the people and the establishment is the idea that the establishment has failed. It won't listen. And that there has to be really dramatic change in the country. Sanders talked about a political revolution. Maybe that's too dramatic a term, but that there has to be major changes, and those won't occur right away. So the populists see themselves as the beginning. And as a rule, they're best off when they're out of power rather than in power, because often when this happened in Greece, when the populist party actually got in rule, it found that it didn't have the clout behind it to do what it wanted to do.
Talk about the analogy, if there is one, between the Brexit vote in Great Britain and the populist movement as represented by Mr. Trump here in America. Immigration at the core of the Brexit, the leave contingent,
right,
in that debate. Are there analogies? I mean, who were the folks that were voting to leave the European Union? And is there a complementary sector here in the United States?
Well, to start off with this thing called the United Kingdom Independence Party, which was the party that
UKIP
really inspired all this. And UKIP's constituency used to be, you would say, more in the middle class, upper middle class, people who would have voted conservative who had the kind of nostalgia for old England and didn't like the idea that Great Britain was part of the European Union. It wasn't by any means a kind of hard-edged working-class party in that sense. But in the European Union, they have these things called the Schengen Agreement, which allows immigrants from any country within the EU to go to any other country. So when Britain joined the European Union and agreed to its terms, it became susceptible to the Schengen agreements. And Tony Blair in 2004 could have waited 7 years to implement them, but he wanted it right away. And so there has been this huge influx of particularly of Eastern European immigrants into a lot of the working class towns in Great Britain. So what happened in the course of that was that UKIP was transformed from this kind of, the word would be petty bourgeois party into a working class party. Its base became as much the working class communities, the people who felt left behind, as the people who were nostalgic about old England. Now, again, Trump talks about turning the Republican Party into a workers' party. And I think that there and his base is very similar to this new base that UKIP or the National Front. A lot of these parties in Europe are now working class parties, and they're displacing, for instance, the socialists and old communist parties.
Yeah, Marie Le Pen is running on the Nationalist Front Party in France, and will, it looks like, be a candidate for president in 2017, so we'll have to see.
She'll certainly be a candidate, yeah, and she's leading in some of the polls now.
410-662-8780 is the number to call to be part of our conversation here with John Judas on Midday. Our email, midday@wipr.org. You can send us a tweet, @Midday, Tom Hall. To your point that you're making about the Republican Party perhaps being transformed into a workers' party, we have a email here from a listener who wishes to remain anonymous in Towson. It says, please comment on Trump's railing against China and companies shipping business there, and yet he and his daughter's companies manufacture all their clothes in China. This brings up an interesting notion that there are a lot of things that Mr. Trump is saying. You mentioned the wall. People don't really believe the wall is going to happen, yet they believe in the message that Mr. Trump is sending. Those things, how do you reconcile those things, those two things?
Oh, that's for the voters to decide. I'm not, I don't think Trump would make a good president. A lot of the things he says are pretty goofy and crazy. And
so is this just sort of a matter of, hypocrisy and inconsistency?
In other words,
it doesn't seem like Mr. Trump has to demonstrate anything in his own business dealings to convince the people who are supporting him that he would be able to make this transformation happen in the Republican Party and in the country as a whole.
Well, look, I think Trump grew up as a real estate developer. That was his business. Real estate developers tend to begin are national, not international. He now has international business. But his outlook, his underlying outlook, is a kind of economic nationalism. I don't think he's lying to people when he espouses these things. But as a businessman, he does things that are completely contrary to his principles. His first priority has been to make money, not to be an example for others to follow politically.
All right, we'll have more on this after a quick break. It's Midday on 88.1 WIPR. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, looking ahead to tomorrow, my guest will be Republican delegate Kathy Schlage. She's running against Democrat Chris Van Hollen and Green Party candidate Margaret Flowers for the U.S. Senate. John Judas is my guest today. He's an editor-at-large at Talking Points Memo. He was senior editor at The New Republic. His new book is called The Populist Explosion, How the Recession Transformed American and European Politics. You can join us by giving us a buzz, 410-662-8780. You can send me a tweet @MiddayTomHall or drop me an email, midday@wipr.org. More with John Judas after a break. Stick around. back. It's midday here on 88.1 WIPR. I'm Tom Hall. We've had 10 recessions between 1948 and 2011, the most recent of which began in 2007 in December and ended officially in June of 2009, although I think a lot of folks thought it ended a lot later than that. Roughly 8.7 million jobs were lost between February 2008 and February of 2010. The GDP contracted by 5.1%, making the Great Recession the worst in the United States since the Great Depression. We had an unemployment rate that rose from 4.7% in November of 2007 to 10% in October of 2009. John Judas is my guest today on Midday. His latest book is called The Populist Explosion: How the Great Recession Transformed American and European Politics. He'll be at the Ivy Bookshop talking about his new book on Thursday evening. You can join the conversation. Give us a call, 410-662-8780. You can send us an email, midday@wipr.org, or a tweet at midday Tom Hall. Bill is on the line from Owings Mills. Bill, thanks for your call to Midday. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Tom, for taking my call. I just have an issue with Mr. Judas' description of the middle class, because he seems to suggest that the whole middle class in America is angry with what's happening. But I think that he is trying to generalize a white Dixiecrat middle class for everybody else, because the black middle class, the Hispanic middle class, the Asian middle class, they are all against what Mr. Trump and his supporters are doing. And also, his depiction of where this anger started, I think is probably a little less, it's not as correct, because you can tell that the anger was more to do with the ascendancy of Obama than the recession or the depression. So in general, I think Mr. Judas is minimizing the racial aspect of this. Even in Europe, where he's talking about Brexit, that was driven more by racist attitudes that the right wing there had against what they thought were the foreigners coming into the country.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you're putting a lot of economic context to something that is basically at the heart of it, a racial issue.
All right, Bill. Bill, thank you for your call. Yeah, thank you for your call, Bill. I appreciate it. You know, this is something
comment
that other folks have observed as well. E.J. Dion wrote a book called Why the Right Went Wrong, basically chronicling the conservative movement from Barry Goldwater all the way through Donald Trump. And he says that, you know, a typical meme was to blame people's antipathy towards President Obama as the first black president. But in fact, there's a long tradition of conservatives getting further and further and further to the right as, you know, as we progressed. But there is a very strong racial element in this campaign, for sure. I think Bill's hit on something very, very important.
Look, when there's no question that there's a racial element in American politics. There has been for whatever, 400 years. But the anger against Obama resembles very much the anger against Bill Clinton especially during his second term. People forget that conservatives and a lot of the same people that are now up in arms against Obama were up in arms against Bill Clinton. And if Hillary Clinton had been elected in 2008, I don't think the scenario would be that much different. Now, I think there's a difference between saying that there are racial factors and explaining away the anger as simply a result of racism. Barack Obama won Ohio in two elections. Hillary Clinton is now having trouble there with Trump. Is that because of racism? I don't think so. I think in a state like Ohio, what Trump says about trade and corporations rings a lot of bells. I think also if you look at the, again, going back to this idea of the middle class, there is a similarity in the populist sentiment of the Sanders voters and the Trump voters, the idea that there's a rigged economy, for instance, that there is something called, Trump calls it establishment elite. Sanders talked about a billionaire class. So something's happening, and it isn't just white people that are involved. With Trump, it definitely is, as it is with Republicans, a primarily white constituency. But I think if you look at the American middle class, something is going on. And what's going on is a growing dissatisfaction with these kind of policies that have grown out of 1970s and 1980s. We're reaching a kind of point of crisis.
Let's go to the phones again. Jay has been patient on the line from Baltimore. You've got race on your mind as well. Jay, welcome to Midday. Thanks for your call.
Thank you very much. I very much enjoyed the conversation so far, and of course I can't help but agree that the economic problems have a big role in it. But like the gentleman before, though, I do think you're discounting race. Now, I'm a white guy, you know, and in talking with folks I know, and in my own reading, I have come to the conclusion that what is happening, and perhaps this is in the most positive light you can see, is that America is beginning to really realize, potentially anyway, realize its true role as a multiracial society, with everyone basically having access to equal opportunity. Obviously, that hasn't happened yet, but what I'm saying is we have been a white country for a long time. What I mean by that is, you know, in TV and movies up until the late 60s, most of my parents' generation grew up as this was a white country. African-Americans, Hispanics, they were people on the lower rungs that any white person, no matter how poor, could look down on and say, well, at least I'm not one of them. Now, in the 60s, we had our legal revolution that won civil rights, but that still wasn't a social revolution. And I think what's happening now, and it's kind of a perfect storm between the recession in the early 2000s, And is also that we are, with demands from like Black Lives Matter, this awareness of how the police treat African Americans, you can throw in a whole bunch of things. But I think there are a lot of white people out there who very easily throw off their resentments and fears and anxieties onto non-white people. Mm-hmm. And I'm talking particularly, I mean, you know, when you have a guy who's been laid off, okay, you can sort of understand, not agree with it, but you can see it. You know, how racism can evolve in that. But when you see a lot of very comfortable white people in senior citizen positions, you know, getting their Medicare, getting their Social Security, getting their prescription drug program, comfortable as anything, they've got the rest of their lives laid out, pretty nice, and they are still Trump supporters, still railing against the immigrants, I can't help but see there's a racial component here.
So, John, one more comment about the race issue here?
Well, I'll just say a personal thing, a story about it. In 2008, I was writing about the election, and I decided to do a piece in February or so of 2008 using all this data from social science research, these surveys that have been done over the last 40 years that have included all kinds of complicated questions that are meant to bring out racial resentment. And I proved, I thought, pretty conclusively that Obama couldn't be elected president. Now,
smart call there, John. That's good.
Yeah. What I learned from that, again, is that Americans have a more complex set of decision-making processes involved in political choices than a lot of social scientists assume. I took one of these tests myself about racial prejudice, and I came out pretty bad because I come from Chicago, and you get brought up with all these kind of implicit assumptions. But, you know, I was civil rights movement. I voted for people. It's not so. I think you get misled by too simple a model of why people make political decisions. And by reducing everything to race in this country, you in effect make the problem worse.
Yeah, of course, we don't want to reduce everything to race, but race certainly is an element that needs to be considered.
I know, but that's what that analysis, what that fellow was saying.
Here's Teresa sending us an email. Says, hey, can you please talk about how people can't work 40 hours a week full-time with benefits anymore because employers don't want to pay them their benefits. Imagine if Walmart had full-time employees and how much that could boost the working and middle class. I mean, obviously, income inequality, you write about this, that, you know, this was at the heart of the Depression in the 20s. And FDR, when he was elected in 1932, did not initially address economic inequality. He talked about reducing the size of government and cutting spending. Right. You know, the inequality that we have, a lot of folks have noticed that it's getting to, you know, staggering and very frightening levels here.
Well, it becomes a big issue in America when the economy turns down. There was a lot of inequality during the late 1990s, during the internet boom. That's when you had all these fabulously rich people emerging. But people were not as upset about it as they became in the wake of the Great Recession. So, yes, it is a big issue now. And I expect, absent another boom, that it will remain so.
We've got a comment from David in Baltimore who writes that organized capital is beating organized labor in the political battle now that is playing out. Populism, he says, is a distraction. Do you think that populism is this thing still out on the left and the right fringes, or is it because of, you know, the ascendancy of candidates like Mr. Sanders and Mr. Trump becoming much more central to the political debate in America?
Well, in American politics, and this is true to some extent in Europe too, populism is a kind of early warning signal that things have gone awry. And that the leadership of both the big parties, Democrats, Republicans, Christian Democrats, Social Democrats in Europe, are not listening to the voters and are not responding to the kind of problems in the country. And I think that that's happening very much now, and that was the basis for Trump and Sanders' success.
We have time for one more comment. This comes from Jeff via email. He says, am I the only one that sees the irony of Donald Trump not paying taxes for maybe 18 years, according to the New York Times, which leaves him with little in common with the middle class? He says, I pay taxes. I mean, the fact that there seems to be very little commonality in the lifestyle of Donald Trump and many of the people who support him, does that strike you as surprising?
No. It doesn't. I mean, Huey Long, for instance, used to use the most highfalutin language because his supporters liked the idea that here was this guy with all these cultured terminology talking to them, even if they might not understand Latin words. Trump, to a lot of supporters, is the model of success. He's a billionaire. He's really
aspirational.
Made it. Yeah. So, yeah. I mean, in a way, you know, Giuliani's defense of him, that this shows.
Yeah,
that he really
interesting time.
That he gamed the system.
Yeah, it is an interesting time, and this is an interesting read. John Judas, the book is The Populist Explosion: How the Great Recession Transformed American and European Politics. John Judas will be at the Ivy Bookshop on Falls Road in North Baltimore Thursday night for a talk and book signing that begins at 7 o'clock. We've got a link with the details at WIPR.org/midday. Thank you, John. Appreciate it.
Sure. Fun.
We'd like to thank the Diz for supplying lunch today. The Diz is located at 300 West 30th Street in the heart of Remington. Features signature burgers, wings, steaks, and jumbo lump crab cakes. The Diz is open for lunch and dinner with breakfast served on weekends on the web at thedizbaltimore.com. That's it for us today. Coming up on the Tuesday edition of Midday, Delegate Kathy Shalega joins me. She's running for the U.S. Senate seat, being vacated by retiring Senator Barbara Mikulski. And on Wednesday, we'll have analysis and reaction to the vice presidential debate between Mike Pence and Tim Kaine. That's coming up tomorrow and Wednesday here on Midday. Thanks also to Mighty Matt Taka for sitting in for Luke Spicknall at the controls this afternoon. I'm Tom Hall for the entire Midday team. Thanks so much for listening. We'll see you tomorrow. Have a great day.